Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
Veni Creator Spiritus.
The Vatican opened a sex abuse prevention summit in Rome today, with Pope Francis urging senior Catholic Church leaders to listen to the, quote, cry of the young. The Pope offered 21 proposals to punish predators and to try to keep children safe. Mark Coleridge, the Archbishop of Brisbane, Australia, told ABC that this meeting is significant.
It's uncharted territory in the sense that we've never had a meeting like this before, but I think that recognises the unique character of the emergency that we're seeking to address globally, because it is a global emergency. And it needs to be addressed in a global context.
Victims from five continents addressed the summit, recanting the trauma of their abuse and the indifference of the church. We want to spend much of our show today talking about this, and we want to hear from you. Do you think we'll see changes in the Catholic Church? Have you given up on the church? What changes should be made? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. We want to start in Rome, where this meeting is taking place, with John Allen. He's the editor of Crux Magazine, which covers the Vatican. John, thanks for being with us.
Deborah, glad to do it.
So what do you think were maybe one or two of the key proposals that Pope Francis brought forward today?
Well, first of all, these were not proposals. Pope Francis presented them as points for reflection, saying that these were sort of ideas he had collected from bishops' conferences and other Catholic commissions around the world. He said he was submitting these to the bishops to think about, but they were not intended to replace their own thinking about what to do. In terms of what's most important, I don't know. What I can tell you, what's most controversial in those 21 points are two of them. One had to do with the question of when does the church release the names of priests who have either been accused of abusing minors who have actually been found guilty of it. The practice in most American dioceses, including the Archdiocese of Boston, is to release the names of all priests who are facing credible accusations. That is, a preliminary investigation has found that there's reason to think this is a serious charge. But the recommendation presented by the Pope today was that that wouldn't happen until there is a definitive verdict in the case, which, if that were to be taken seriously, would basically undercut the practice of virtually every diocese in America. Another point on that list had to do with the question of defrocking priests, and it certainly was interpreted by survivors who were on hand here in Rome as saying that defrocking wouldn't necessarily be almost automatic, which it is now, for the crime of sexual abuse of a minor. There are lots of indications that those two points may not in the end shape the Vatican's policy on this, but the mere fact that they were floated at this meeting has some survivors of clerical abuse concerned.
It sounds like it's backtracking.
Well, I mean, it's backtracking in the United States, Deborah, but you have to remember that the majority of participants in this meeting don't come from the United States or from Western Europe, where the clerical abuse crisis, as we know it, has been around for more than three decades. Most of them come from the developing world, sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, Eastern Europe. And in those places, the clerical abuse crisis, in the sense of lawsuits and extensive media coverage and public protest, in that sense, the crisis has never arrived. And so it is perhaps not surprising that there isn't a universal consensus across the board about what the proper response to this behavior ought to be.
Now, there are, what, almost 200 senior church leaders in attendance, right?
That's right. 190 is the actual number, and they are presidents of national conferences of bishops from around the world, heads of Eastern churches that are part of the Catholic Church, and also the upper echelon of the Vatican's power structure, as well as leaders of women's and men's religious orders in the Catholic Church. And they have been summoned over these 4 days by Pope Francis to try to talk about what a strong system of child protection in the church would look like.
Mm-hmm. What about this notion of zero tolerance that we've heard so much about? And actually, Cardinal Sean O'Malley of Boston has expressed concerns about. I mean, did the Pope mention at all the idea of having a zero tolerance policy when it came to the sexual abuse of minors?
No, the Pope didn't use that phrase today. Now, he has repeatedly in the past. He has said there must not be a step back from zero tolerance. But the problem, Deborah, is what do people mean by zero tolerance? Mm. I mean, it could simply mean that the church should not, be complicit in the sexual abuse of a child. But that's not what the phrase means in the United States, which is where it comes from in the context of the church's abuse scandals. In the United States, what it means is that any Catholic cleric who is credibly accused of the sexual abuse of a minor should never be in ministry again. In other words, they should be gone. And zero tolerance in that sense is not universally practiced in the church around the world, and it is an open question whether making it universal is going to be an immediate result anyway of the summit that is now taking place here this week.
Is there, do you think, at this summit almost a light shown on what might be a deepening gap between the Vatican and U.S. church leaders because of some of these differences that you're talking about?
Well, I don't think it's between the Vatican and U.S. church leaders. I think it's between U.S. church leaders and church leaders in other parts of the world. Frankly, the Vatican would be, for the most part, supportive of U.S. policies. But I think the plain fact of the matter is that church leaders in many other parts of the world not only have never experienced this crisis, but they don't think that the issue of clerical abuse of children happens in any significant way in their own backyards. And they sometimes resent the attention that this issue gets because they think it is primarily an American and European issue. So if there's a divide here, I think that's it. At Crux, for example, we have an interview today by our senior correspondent, Elise Harris, with a prominent archbishop in Ghana in Africa, who, by the way, interestingly, is kind of a pioneer in trying to implement some of the child protection policies the church recommends. But he very bluntly denies that there is a problem with the sexual abuse of children in Africa. He says it is very, very minimal. This is largely an American and European issue. Hmm. That attitude is fairly widespread, and that's part of the complexity that I think the Pope and his team are dealing with at this summit. Hmm.
You know, I want to go back to Cardinal O'Malley for a moment. We just briefly mentioned him, but there's been some talk as to whether there may be a division between the Cardinal and the Vatican largely because of the way this clergy sex abuse issue has been handled. And, of course, Cardinal Sean O'Malley was appointed to head the Vatican Commission to Protect Children. Are there any signs that there is some kind of a rift there, John? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it is fair to say that Cardinal O'Malley's relationship with Pope Francis is probably not as close today as it was, say, 3 or 4 years ago. There have been some flashpoints. In 2017, it emerged that Pope Francis had approved reducing the punishments that had been assigned to some priests who had been convicted of the sexual abuse of a minor. Cardinal O'Malley strongly protested that move, but he lost that argument. In early 2018, when Pope Francis took a trip to the nation of Chile in Latin America, he publicly accused abuse victims there who were protesting against a bishop that they thought had been involved in the cover-up of sex abuse. The Pope publicly accused them of calumny, basically lying, and Cardinal O'Malley publicly chastised the Pope for doing that and distanced himself from that comment. And in the months since, it has been clear that the Pope now tends to rely on other figures as his sort of go-to people on the sex abuse crisis. I mean, Cardinal O'Malley, for instance, was not named to the organizing committee for the summit that's taking part this mm-hmm. taking place this week. And for someone who, as you say, heads the Pope's own commission that is supposed to be advising him on child protection policies, that was a rather striking omission.
Right, right. So what do you think we can expect from all of this? Do you think that we'll get some clear action plan other than points of reflection? What will we get from this, John?
Well, I think what is going to happen is that bishops from around the Catholic world who come from places that have never dealt with this issue before are going to go home with a clear understanding that this is a global problem. It's not just an American or a European issue, and that they need to begin taking steps to address it. Now, if you live in those parts of the world, that's going to strike you as progress. However, if you are an American or European who's been living with this issue for three decades, your expectations are much higher. You don't simply want bishops to acknowledge there's a problem. What you want is real accountability for that problem. And that means accountability not just for the crime of sex abuse, but for the cover-up. I mean, the recent case of former cardinal and now former priest Theodore McCarrick is illustrative. The fact that Cardinal McCarrick has now been kicked out of the Catholic priesthood signals accountability for the crime of abuse, but the question that remains unanswered is what about other officials in the church who knew about the concerns regarding McCarrick and who didn't do anything about it, who turned a blind eye? To date, there's been no punishment, no accountability for those officials. And I think survivors and their advocates, particularly in the States, are not going to be satisfied with the church's response until they see that kind of accountability.
All right. John Allen, editor of Crux magazine, which covers the church and the Vatican. John, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Deborah.
Listeners, as we said earlier, we do want to take your calls on this. Do you think we will see changes in the Catholic Church? Have you given up on the church? Are you a Catholic? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. For our in-studio conversation, we are also going to be joined from Rome by Anne Barrett Doyle, who's co-director of bishopaccountability.org. Hi there, Anne.
Hi there, Deborah.
You're joining us via Skype. Thanks so much. And with us in studio is Thomas Groom, professor of theology and religious education at Boston College. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you, Deborah.
So, Anne, just briefly, what are you seeing and hearing from other activists who are at the summit in Rome?
Pretty much what John Allen was saying, which is that there is a clear-cut, uncompromising demand for a one strike and you're out policy. You know, I think it turns out, Deb, that this whole time Pope Francis has been espousing zero tolerance. I think all he meant by that is that guilty priests should be punished. But what we're seeing in our research in Catholic churches around the world, outside the United States and in the United States, is that bishops have a great deal of latitude in deciding whether an allegation should move forward, an investigation should move forward. And universal canon law outside the U.S. allows a bishop to return a guilty priest to ministry if the bishop feels he is no longer poses a risk. So outside the United States, canon law is not what we think of as zero tolerance. And it's just appalling, frankly, that the Vatican, some of these countries are still at the awareness building stage. You know, it is absolutely an indicator that this has been a low priority for the Vatican. The Pope and the Vatican rushes to do things when they're in the glare of the media spotlight. But otherwise, they have allowed countries to put this issue on the back burner, and that's no longer acceptable.
And so we'll talk about this in a bit because I want to hear from Professor Groom, but some have said, you know, in other countries it's very different, right? There are cultural differences. So a zero tolerance policy has to be carefully worded to take those cultural differences into account. I want to ask Professor Groom about that first, and then we'll go back to you on it, okay? And what would you say
sure.
about that,
well,
Professor?
Thank you, and hello, Anne. I think the resistance to it is, in many contexts, is deeply cultural. And the fact that they don't have reported cases doesn't mean that there are no cases. Mm. It simply means they're refusing to talk about it. And I come from an old culture myself, so I can understand those kind of deep cultural resistances, and especially to deny, and particularly around priesthood and the kind of adulation, pedestalizing, glorifying that Catholic culture, at least, has surrounded its priests. That it does, in a more traditional culture, that isn't to put down traditional cultures, there is that resistance even to talking about it, whether it's in the family or in the church or wherever it's taking place. So that the fact that it's not being talked about, or that bishop or archbishop from Ghana was denying that there's real problem, that there's no problem in Ghana, that doesn't mean there isn't a problem in Ghana. I'm sure there is a problem in Ghana. Now, it is possible, I suppose, to imagine cultural differences in the kind of sins and crimes that people commit. For example, I have friends who are claiming that the abuse of nuns, of sisters, is much more prevalent in developing countries than it is in our countries here. I mean, American sisters are highly educated, sophisticated women. They wouldn't be treated that way, wouldn't allow themselves to be treated that way. But in contexts and cultures where the nun, the sister, is more dependent on the priest, that there can be real abuse, that there can be a type of sexual abuse there that is very destructive and terrifying, terrible crimes. So that whether it's always against children or not, I think we're just especially with the McCarrick incident, we're just beginning to realize that the power differential between a cardinal and a seminarian, and in some cultures between a priest and a nun, may indeed be very problematic by way of clergy sex abuse. So I can imagine variation, and yet the fact that it is present in all of our cultures and throughout the church, I think nobody can deny that or doubt it.
Right. Anne, what are your thoughts about the potential cultural differences and how that might affect things here?
Oh, cultural differences exist, but you don't accommodate those when it comes to child molestation. You know, there was a Brazilian priest, a psychologist, who spoke to the Vatican. The Vatican had a conference sort of on a smaller scale, just like this one in 2012. And he speculated that the reason you don't hear much about this issue in Brazil, which is the world's largest Catholic country, is that there may be a larger cultural acceptance of child sexual abuse. But even if that is so, the church does not accommodate that. It cannot accommodate that. The one strike and you're out rule can apply. It must apply to every country in the world. The church often boasts that it is a model for other institutions in terms of child safety. Well, let that be so in countries where other institutions are not acknowledging the problem. Let the church be the first institution to acknowledge the problem. But you don't accommodate culture when it comes to the sexual violence towards kids.
Right. I'm not sure that they're saying accommodate, but I think they're saying just carefully word this idea of zero tolerance and how it might get reported to authorities and different things like that, because in different countries they have different practices,
right? I mean, you know, you're absolutely right, Deb. So when it comes to reporting, I mean, there are some countries like the Philippines where Catholic priests are getting killed. Mm-hmm. And in other countries that we looked at. So you do have to be careful about publicly identifying abusers, and certainly about publicly identifying victims in certain countries. But it's not hard to generate a list of those countries, and that's different from zero tolerance. You know, publicizing names is a different issue.
I want to make sure we get some callers in here. Joe is calling from Reading. Joe, you're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah, I was a Catholic. I'm in my 70s now. I went to grammar school with nuns. Monks had me in high school and Jesuits in college. And whoa. I am disgusted with the church, okay? Hmm. The problem is, it's the celibacy of priests. This whole idea, this patriarchal society, is just ridiculous. Jesus had female disciples. He had Mary Magdalene wrote a gospel which the early church councils dismissed because they were just a bunch of men and had no regard for women. You don't see nuns doing this to kids. And the fact, as long as the Catholic Church keeps itself as this just men, and nuns can put flowers on the altar, and that's about it, and take care of priests, we're going to keep having this. You know, I never would have believed this was possible all my life. I had a friend of mine in, when I lived in California 30 years ago. He told me he was abused by a priest. I didn't believe him. I thought it was crazy. I never heard of such a thing. Mm. Now, when I hear priests in Ghana or any place else say it doesn't happen, that's ridiculous. Of course it happens. It's institutionalized. And no matter what they do, as long as they just keep men doing this and celibate men, they're going to have this same problem. So I think they're irrelevant. They're back 2,000 years ago.
All right. Joe, thanks so much for the call. It's an interesting point, and I know, Professor Groom, you've written about this, about some ideas about revising the priesthood and celibacy. What are your thoughts? Does Joe have a point?
Well, you know, the Holy Father said recently that the future of priesthood cannot be the same as the present, or certainly not the same as the past. So I think we are in a new moment to revisit and revise. And in a sense, the Second Vatican Council began the process for us to revising the whole understanding of priesthood. I mean, and some of our exaggerated and inflated understanding of priesthood goes back to the Council, goes back to the Reformation, the 16th century, because when Luther and Calvin and the other reformers were emphasizing the priesthood of all the baptized, the Catholic Church downplayed the priesthood of all the baptized and upplayed the priesthood of the ordained person. And as a result, we end up with a very inflated understanding of priesthood. The Catechism of the Council of Trent, which was the primary document that implemented the council, refers to priests as gods. Mm. Now, it's a small g, but even so, they're gods.
That's
when Sister Bridget told me in second grade, when I was passing through the village, if I met Father Murphy and my guardian angel, I should salute Father Murphy first, because he was closer to God than even the angels. Now, a lot of that was in Catholic culture, but still, that type of adulation, pedestalizing, and there is a certain kind of rarefying, exceptionalizing that comes along with the celibacy. Not only does it, and it excludes women from the lives of priests in ways that they could be enormous. And a very significant presence, and not only them as partners and mothers, but as grandmothers. I've often said that, you know, if Cardinal Law had a couple of grandmothers in his cabinet here in Boston, that this clergy sex abuse scandal would have been revealed far sooner. They never would have allowed him to keep moving these people around. So that there is an absence. Joe is right. There is an absence of real presence of women's voices in my church, and that's tragic.
So
it has to change.
Should we get rid of the celibacy requirement in the church?
Well, it sounds as if Pope Francis is ready to talk about it, at least. There's a big synod coming up in May, the bishops of the Amazon area of South America, where the very often Catholic communities there have the Eucharist once a year because they don't have priests. And at least Pope Francis is certainly open to the conversation about optional celibacy. And I think it's high time.
I want to bring a voice in here of a woman who has worked in the church, and her name is Dr. Alice Laffey. She's a professor emerita of religious studies at
Indeed.
The College of the Holy Cross, former nun.
Yes,
she's a nun for 25 years for the Sisters of Mercy. And, you know, she talks about this imbalance of power issue throughout the church, and she says this is the big, big problem. And, of course, this month, the Pope acknowledged for the first time that there was a problem with the sexual abuse of nuns priests. So, even though this may have been overshadowed, we checked in with Dr. Laffey earlier today to ask her thoughts, and she says the Vatican needs to take steps first on this power imbalance. Let's listen to a little bit of what she told us.
There has been the opening of floodgates about the abuse of power, most especially right now as applied to sexuality. In the hierarchy of the church, nuns were second or third class citizens. So, you know, I could tell story after story of subtle ways in which nuns were maltreated. I can't speak a lot to, you know, any kind of sexual harassment of American nuns. That was not majorly in my experience. When I went to Rome, I experienced not sexual harassment of myself, but I experienced an all-male culture, which I used to describe as the stag party before a wedding. You know, a lot of, like, sex jokes and all that sort of stuff. There's a certain percentage of priests who have used that power to abuse women, to abuse children, to abuse those who were seen as vulnerable to whom they had access.
Well, that's Dr. Alice Laffey, who's a professor at the College of the Holy Cross, former nun. And I'm wondering, Professor Groom, you know, describing being a nun in this environment as being at a stag party before the wedding. What do you make of that? I think we mentioned nuns earlier. We said it may be better in the U.S. than it is in other countries.
Alice said that, too, that she had not experienced it as right here.
Right.
Whereas in the developing countries, apparently, there is more subservience on the part of the sisters. Just structurally, than there is to priests. And so that does allow for a kind of abuse that I don't think would happen nearly as often here.
But would giving women more of a voice help, and why?
Well, of course it would. And I mean, they deserve a voice. What Joe, our first caller, said is very appropriate. I mean, Jesus had women disciples in his inner core of disciples. It's very clear. It says in all three synoptic gospels that the women at the foot of the cross had come up from Galilee with him, which means if you take John's chronology of John's gospel, they'd been with him for the whole 3 years. And they'd been in part of his inner circle. Mary Magdalene is the first witness of the resurrection. And all of that, in many ways, it was a consciousness far more present in the early Christian communities, but we lost it. We lost it as we came through the Middle Ages and on into the modern era and so on. For some reason, that was forgotten. Mary Magdalene was posed as a sinner, as the temptress, rather than the witness to the resurrection, which was a total caricature of the woman. So there's a whole history there that we've got to revise and reclaim the life-giving pieces, and especially by way of total inclusivity. There's no function or service in the church that should not be open to Catholic women. And to say otherwise, that the reasons that I have a friend who likes to say that if the Catholic Church wishes to continue to exclude its women from leadership and from ordination to orders, then it better come up with better reasons, because the reasons that it's given so far are no longer convincing.
Mm. All right, I want to take another call here. Bruce is calling from Fitchburg. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, the point I wanted to make is this kind of thing happens in all kinds of churches. There was a story that NPR did about a Hasidic Jewish group in New York, and you read what happened to the victims when they reported it, and it's exactly the same thing. So I don't, you know, they were castigated. They said, oh, how could you say this thing about this holy person? And it just shows that this is an organizational, you know, this is like organization theory 101. And it has nothing to do with the fact that these people are celibate. You can find LDS, you know, if you type in LDS sex, you know, child abuse on a web search engine or anything.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, you're saying it has, right.
You can find it anywhere.
Any organization.
It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the organization saying, no, we have to preserve ourselves, and rearing back and striking out at the victims.
All right, Bruce, thanks so much. Thanks so much. Professor, you want to say
well,
something?
Well, I think it's prevalent in closed communities. I think where communities are open and are accountable and are transparent in their practices, I think it's far less likely. I mean, it has emerged now in the Southern Baptist Communion, but again, it's a fairly rigorous, closed type of traditional community, or the previous caller's example of in the Hasidic communities. Mm-hmm. I think it's more likely in those enclosed communities than it is in open communities that are publicly accountable. I think that's where the Catholic Church has to move, to public transparency and accountability. And that's one of my hopes out of this synod, is that the Catholic, that at least the American Catholic bishops will be able to come back and pick up the work that they were doing last November, when they were going to revise the Dallas Charter in such a way that it would hold bishops accountable.
Right.
And I think that would be a huge asset, at least for our country. And now if we can't have that for the whole world, at least let's have it in this country here.
Anne, would you say that's the same, that you're hoping to get back to what they were doing before and revising the charter to hold bishops accountable for what happens?
That would definitely be a step in the right direction. But I think that what we're hearing today, Deborah, is that from the Pope, and he released a list of 21 reflection points. Mm-hmm. And it seems that there were implicit rebukes there, I think, to the U.S. bishops point number 14 was sort of rebuking them, saying, you better prevent the lists of the accused being published until there is definitive condemnation. And then, as John Allen was talking about, their point number 15 was that there should be proportionality considered when deciding if a guilty priest has to be yanked from the priesthood. So there is no way that bishop accountability is emerging from the summit. If anything, we seem to be hearing the Pope going away from the American direction that is quite flawed, by the way, but at least has some greater degree of transparency and accountability than other countries do.
I want to bring up another issue, and because this has been in the news as well, and that is priests who father children. Just this week, the New York Times reported that the Vatican has confirmed that it has secret guidelines to deal with priests who become fathers. And we spoke earlier today with a man who, after decades of detective work and a grave exhumation and DNA testing, found out that his father is the late Father Thomas Sullivan, a priest from Lowell. Jim Graham now lives in South Carolina, and when we spoke with him earlier, he told us this incredible story that started with family members hinting at who his biological father was, and then he and his wife followed clues to a church in Lowell where he says he found a priest who knew his father.
He invited us to a room down the hall. He sat behind a big ornate desk. My wife and I sat on each side of the desk. He pointed at my wife. He said, are you an attorney? She said, no. He pointed at me. He said, are you an attorney? And I said, no. So I said to him, then you know. He said, yeah, I know. I said, well, how do you know? He said, you look just like him.
Hmm. Oh, my gosh. Then you tracked down a nun who actually had a journal of your father's where she said he had acknowledged that you existed, and she wrote to you, Sister Mary, she writes, ever since Saturday, all I can see is your beautiful, smiling face when I open the door. You have no idea how you affected me. You are the very image of your father. As I told you, I was in the hospital when he died. I never really grieved until I saw you. That must have been an unbelievably emotional time to meet Sister Mary, as you call her, so you don't reveal her identity, but also she was really the person who knew your father and confirmed his identity to you and told you you were on the right trail.
Exactly. She was the first person, or the only person, to ever say, your father. Everybody else referred to my father as Father Thomas Sullivan, but not your father. So that luncheon that my wife and I had with Sister Mary was very emotional, probably the most extraordinary meeting I had in my 25-year search for the truth.
How did you prove then that, how did you prove that Thomas Sullivan was your father?
So the next step I took was to write to the order in Washington, to a Father Studert, who is the provincial of the Oblates. And he said, you may think you're Father Sullivan's son, but you can't prove it. But I said, I can't prove I'm Father Sullivan's son if I can exhume his body and take samples for a DNA test. And 2 weeks later, I get a letter back saying that I could. I was totally surprised, and I just still believe that they probably never thought I would take the steps to do it, because it was difficult, it was expensive, and it was very emotional. Dr. Anne Marie Myers from Massachusetts did the exhumation, and we got the results back, and I told that Dr. Myers, don't tell me on the phone, I want you to tell me in person. So I drove up to Paxton, Massachusetts, and she told me the results, that I was 99.999%. Positive that I was Father Sullivan's son.
And how did you feel then?
You know, I knew from the day I saw the obituary photograph of my father's face, and he had, I had his eyes, I had his nose, I had his mouth, I had his chin, so I knew what the results would be, but still, it was very emotional.
Hmm. Do you know what Father Sullivan's relationship was with your mother?
It was a long relationship. It was, it started, you know, back in 1945, and my mother left Buffalo with me as a toddler. My father left the order at the same time, and we escaped from Buffalo. And the church was insistent that he would come back to the order, and he wouldn't be out here as a loose cannon with a parishioner's wife and a baby. So private detectives were hired, and they found us after about 8 months, and they took him back into the Oblate Order, put him in a camp up in Essex, New York, for rehabilitation. And they took me from my mother's custody and put me in the home of John Graham, her former husband, to make it look like I was his son.
And so where did your mother go?
My mother stayed in New York and eventually married a New York City cop. She didn't have visiting rights initially to see us, but she would see us, you know, periodically, just a few days out of the year. Eventually, she got visiting rights in 1954.
And if a priest had a relationship with a parishioner that resulted in the birth of a child, they could literally come and take the priest back and remove the child from the mother?
That's what they did. And I have all the documents that prove that.
And now, we have a report in the New York Times this week that the Vatican has guidelines for dealing with priests who father children. What do you make of that?
Well, the article said they have secret guidelines, if you noticed. So they've been working on these for, I think, 10 or 15 years. And the guidelines that they have, you know, it appears that they're not very rigid. They're kind of a priest can leave the order if he wants to and, take care of his child financially and, emotionally. But he doesn't have to. So I don't think there's enough teeth in those guidelines to really have much of an effect.
What do you think should be done?
Well, first of all, it should be transparency. You look in my case, this is 7 decades, and I still don't have transparency from the church because even after I got the results, I never heard from them. All along, they knew who I was, and I knew that they knew that. But yet they put me through this very difficult situation to exhume my father's body to prove it, and they knew all along. So you look at the other children of priests, and we all have unique situations. They're all different. But still, I think the Catholic Church is good at cover-ups. They're good at stonewalling. And the last thing they want to do is admit a fault that they made years ago.
So when you hear about this meeting that's happening today, this Vatican summit, are you optimistic that there will be something done about the priesthood to try to hold people more accountable for the activities of the sexual activities of priests?
I think it's an overwhelming situation, and I don't know how the Catholic Church can just make a quick turn and correct it. It's almost like they need a CEO to come in there and to do what has to be done, and not just transfer priests to other parishes and forget about it, and don't tell the truth about what happened in the original parish, but to really eliminate those people. It's a big task, and I just don't know how they're going to do it. I'm less sanguine than other people about the outcome.
That is really incredible. It's an incredible story, and I'm glad you were able to piece it all together. It sounds like it took an enormous amount of persistence and some really good luck, too.
It did.
So thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
That's Jim Graham, who confirmed that Father Thomas Sullivan of Lowell, who is buried in Tewksbury, was his father. Professor Tom Groom, we have just a little bit of time left. What do you do? What do we do about priests? Should they be removed if they father children?
I think it's no secret, Deborah, that celibacy has had very varied success, shall we say, across the past 1,000 years. It became a law in the 12th century, so the church functioned for 1,200 years or 1,100 years without it. And it has greatly varied in its implementation, both here and abroad and throughout the world. In some cultures, it's very strange, and it's certainly as a requirement and a precondition for priesthood. It seems terribly ill-advised.
Thomas Groom, Professor of Theology and Religious Education at Boston College, thanks for being with us. Ann Barrett Doyle with bishopaccountability.org. Ann, thanks for standing by for the show today.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.